On June 16th, the Daily Mirror reports that the sleeve for their American LP Yesterday and Today has been withdrawn as being too offensive. The cover showed the Beatles dressed in butcher smocks holding chunks of raw meat and decapitated baby dolls. One of the reasons given for this uncharacteristic action was that it was meant as a satire on Capitol Records. It was believed that Capitol had butchered some of their songs in the way they remixed them, and that they left some songs off albums for later release. The cover was meant only for release in the U.S. The next day, the Mirror reports that Paul McCartney has bought a 183-acre dairy farm in Scotland overlooking the Mull of Kintyre. He always wanted a farm in Scotland. It may even be a good name for a song someday. Starting on June 24th, the Beatles spent 3 days touring Germany. For the tumultuous welcome in Hamburg, the force of 500 police have to use water cannons to control the fans. The next day, they're off to Japan to spend 5 nights in a judo arena before leaving for Manila.
Thank you, everybody. You can hear us. Now it's my turn. We'd like to sing another song, I think. This song was it a single? Yeah, this song was a single over here. Maybe. The song's called Day Tripper.
Fifty 50,000 excited fans block all traffic to and from the airport. But the worst problem is that through a misunderstanding, they miss a reception at the president's palace. Victor Lewis, who arranged the tour.
Somebody said that we're supposed to be at the garden party. I know nothing about it. I'm sure you don't. Of course, he said he didn't. And he said, we're not going. So I said, now, wait a minute. I don't think we ought to say we're not going. I said, we're in a foreign country. And I think we ought to think about it. So Brian, in the way that he was, turned around and said, I'm not thinking about it. As far as I'm concerned, we received no official invitation from the palace or from the president, and as such, I'm not going to have the boys go around there.
They wouldn't have wanted to attend in any case, but the mistake is taken as an insult, and they were lucky to get through the angry crowds at the airport. Paul says later that he wouldn't send his worst enemy to Manila. Later on in July, Prime Minister Harold Wilson, who came from Liverpool and was always a big Beatles fan, reopens the Cavern Club for business. The Beatles are not in attendance, but send a telegram. At the end of July, the world's penchant for misunderstanding the Beatles continues. In Birmingham, Alabama, they dig out the interview from the Evening Standard of London in which John innocently said that he thought the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ. He said, Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right, and I'll be proved right. We are more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. Stations that have never played the Beatles' music before institute a ban on their records, and there are some ceremonial burnings. The DJ that started the ban explains.
The response so far has just been sensational. Here in Birmingham, we've had a 99% cooperative attitude, and as you may have heard all across the country, the stations are jumping on the bandwagon. And I think within another 10 days to 2 weeks, you're going to see a tremendous increase in the number of stations that have banned the Beatle records. And I think this is good. It came about because of a magazine article in Datebook magazine reprinting an interview in London with Maureen Cleave in which John Lennon was quoted as saying Christianity was on its way out and that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ. And we felt that it was so absurd and such an insane statement. We felt we had a public service to do, and we banned the Beatle records. We've also asked our listeners to bring all of their Beatle paraphernalia and Beatlemania to the station. We have a big bonfire scheduled for August 19th. I just talked to a reporter, and he asked me about my religious affiliation and if I was a religious fanatic or something, and I gave him my answer that I was not, and I attended church sort of regularly, but this had nothing to do with it. It was just that I was completely revulsed by the idea that a group like the Beatles, who are idolized by so many young people, could come out and make a statement like this. I just think their responsibility should go up with their success.
Brian Epstein makes a statement.
The quote which John Lennon made to a London columnist more than 3 months ago has been quoted and represented entirely out of context. Lennon is deeply interested in religion and was at the time having serious talks with Maureen Cleave, who is both a friend of the Beatles and a representative for the London Evening Standard. What he said and meant was that he was astonished that in the last 50 years, the church in England, and therefore Christ, had suffered a decline in interest. He did not mean to boast about the Beatles' fame. He meant to point out that the Beatles' effect appeared to be, to him, a more immediate one upon certainly the younger generation.
Amidst this latest controversy, Parlophone releases another single and LP on the 5th day of August, 1966. The single is Yellow Submarine, backed with Eleanor Rigby, both of which were considered A-sides, and both of which were on the album released that day. The album was called Revolver. Other titles suggested were Bubble and Squeak, Magic Circles, Beatles on Safari, and Freewheeling Beatles.
We used to travel along on tour in the car when we had a new album and just for hours and hours be thinking and just saying titles, things that may be titles. I remember specifically on that Revolver album, it was good because, you know, it went round and round. But it seemed so simple, it's perfect.
The new album was brilliantly conceived and executed. It took the world by surprise and became an instant classic. The extra time they spent on the record was well worth it, and many years later it still stands the test of time. It was the first time, with the exception of Yesterday, that the Beatles brought in session men.
Well, it was basically an attempt to get more colour into our records and to get... I mean, the Beatles were always looking for new sounds, and they were always looking to a new horizon. And it was a continual... it was a continual strain to try and provide new things for them. And they were always wanting to try new, maybe new instruments, that kind of thing, and they didn't know much about instruments.
We did a lot of learning together. He had a very great musical knowledge and background, so he could translate for us and suggest a lot of things, which he did, you know, and he'd come up with amazing technical things like slowing down the piano and playing it slow and putting it on and things like that, you know, where we'd be saying, well, can we, we're on it, go, and he'd say, well, look, chaps, I thought of this afternoon. Last night I was talking to whoever he was talking, and I came up with this, you know, and he said, oh, great, we'll put it on here, you know. But he also come up with things like, well, have you heard an oboe? Oh, which one's that? Is this one?
The album starts off with a tune by George Harrison. This time around, he gets three songs included. The first one laments everybody's villain, the taxman. The song is a saga of discontent about the tax collector taking 19 shillings out of every 20 the Beatles made. The record opens with a candid recording of the Beatles in the studio.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Should 5% appear too small? Thankful I don't take it all. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car, I'll tax the street. If you try to sit, I'll tax your feet. If you get too cold, I'll tax the heat. If you take a walk, I'll tax your feet. Don't ask me what I wanted.
The next song started off with Paul sitting at the piano getting the first line of a melody. It was originally going to be Miss Daisy Hawkins picking up the rice after a wedding. He didn't like that name, and one day while walking around Bristol waiting for Jane Asher, he saw the name Rigby, and eventually got Eleanor Rigby. Father McKenzie was originally Father McCartney, but he didn't want the song to be associated with his dad, so he went through a phone book and came up with Father McKenzie. It's a beautiful song in its complete form, and uses a string octet, 4 violins, 2 violas, and 2 cellos, tastefully arranged by George Martin.
Picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father McKenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Ah, look at all the lonely people. Ah, look at all the lonely people. Eleanor Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came. Father McKenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved, all the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong?
John continues his playing with backward tapes on this next song, although those sounds were actually produced by George Martin and George Harrison. The Beatles wanted John to sound like he was asleep, or singing in his sleep. John never liked the sound of his voice, and was always after George Martin to change its texture.
I don't know why, because I always think he had the greatest of voices, but it's a kind of, I guess it's the same problem you have when you wake up in the morning and you shave yourself and you look at your face and say, what an awful face. It's a kind of self-destruct thing. And he was always wanting to distort it, always wanting me to do things to it, ADT it or double track it or whatever. And don't give me that thing again, George. Give me another one. He was always wanting something different.
George's second piece for the album is also the beginning of his Indian experiments.
I'm using the sitar, but it's not a new instrument. It's over 800 years old. Yeah, it's great. No, it's just a thing I've got interested in over the last year or so. Just got very interested in Indian music generally. I'm just trying to learn it now, and the more I learn, the more I'll try and use it in our music as well. By me using sitar, maybe some of our fans will listen to indie music, and then maybe, you know, those people will get interested in it, which would be good.
It features an all-Indian backup with Anil Bhagwat playing tabla. Norwegian Wood's use of sitar was really just an interesting texture. But this song was the first one where he consciously tried to use the sitar and tabla on the basic track. All the rest was overdubbed later. Another beautiful song from Paul. It turned out to be one of his favorites. He supposedly wrote it as a Beach Boys type song.
Wander everywhere, and if if she's beside me, I know I need never care. But to love her is to need her everywhere. Knowing that love is to share, each one believing that love never dies. Watching her eyes and hoping I'm always there. I want her everywhere, and if she's beside me, I know I need never care.
Of course, any Beatles song can be interpreted in any way the listener sees fit. But the next track really was nothing more than a kiddie song. There are no big words, and it's a simple tune, easy for kids to sing. They obviously had a good time performing it. Ringo is the master of ceremonies for the party, and he conducts Patty Harrison, Mal Evans, Neil Aspinall, George Martin, Jeff Emmerich, the studio staff, and the other three Beatles in the chorus. The submarine sounds were created by John blowing bubbles through a straw, and George swirling water in a bucket. The sounds were pre-recorded and added to the mix later. The song is reminiscent of the Peter Sellers material that George Martin had produced in the 50s.
Then we were embarking on the sound pictures thing. I mean, Yellow Submarine very much was almost a Goon record with John and actually in the studio with a sort of an amplifier, so that he was actually making a sound in the studio through a microphone with his the answers to the voice.
In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed on to the sun till we found the sea of green.
Yeah.
Finishing off side one is a tune of John's that he remembers favorably, all except for the origins of the lyric. It seems they were at a party in Los Angeles. They were under the influence of a mind-altering drug for the second time, and Peter Fonda walked in. Peter kept saying that he knew what it was like to be dead. Much to their displeasure, he kept repeating himself. The experience showed up in the lyric. The heavy accent on guitars gives it the old Beatles sound with a rather bluesy feel. John's voice is as sarcastic as ever. Side 2 of Revolver opens with a composition by Paul which became a favorite of many people. George Martin is playing a muffled honky-tonk piano.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
I need to laugh. And when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's a sunny day.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
We take a walk. The sun is shining down, burns my feet as they touch the ground.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
Then we lie beneath the shady tree. I love her and she's loving me. She feels good. She knows she's looking fine. I'm so proud to know that she is mine.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine.
Here's another typical Lennon song showing he still has the ability to write catchy rock songs. This is a moody but sensational song from Paul, which has a beautiful French horn solo by symphonic player Alan Civil. Paul apparently hummed the solo to George Martin, who took it down on manuscript paper and properly arranged it.
Your day breaks, your mind aches, you find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up. She takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her. And yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years. You stay home, she goes out. She says that long ago she knew someone, but now he's gone, she doesn't need him. Your day breaks, your mind aches. There will be times when all the things she said will fill your head. You won't forget her. And in her eyes you see nothing. No sign of love behind the tears cried for no one. A love that should have lasted years.
Dr. Robert was an in-joke about a doctor in New York who cured his patients by making any number of pills and tranquilizers available to them. It's a fine John Lennon song with a basic 12-bar beat.
Being my friend, I said you called Dr. Robert.
Here's the third piece written by George Harrison. It's a straight-ahead rocker that has a strange static tuning. George says the song is about the avalanche of thoughts that are often hard to write down or say. This piece was influenced by the Tamla Motown sound. Georgie Fame, another big international British jazz pop singer, advised the Beatles on the best musicians for the brass sound they wanted. Trumpeter Les Condon, one of the brass men used on the recording, described the session. He said, "Apparently they felt it needed something extra. That's why we were there. The arrangement, well, they hadn't anything written down, so we just listened to what they had down and got an idea of what they wanted. Most of it went right the first time. Ian and I jotted down some voicings, but eventually everybody chipped in, and the credit must be evenly divided. I suggested something for the trumpets for the ending, and we dubbed that on, too. I didn't think it was quite strong enough, so we dubbed it on with three trumpets again. You'll really be hearing six trumpets in that coda. It was the most relaxing session I've ever been on. The Beatles all seemed very nice fellows, and you know what? They kept asking us things. Ian Hammer and Eddie Thornton play trumpet along with Les Condon. Tenor sax is played by Alan Branscombe and Peter Coe.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. Ooh, and I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life? You didn't run, you didn't lie, you knew I wanted just to hold you. And had you gone, you knew in time we'd meet again, for I had told you. Ooh, you were meant to be near me. Ooh, and I want you to hear me say we'll be together every day. Hard to get you into my life. What can I do, what can I be, when I'm with you I want to stay there. If I'm true I'll never leave, and if I do I know the way there. Ooh, and I suddenly see you. Ooh, did I tell you I need you every single day of my life?
The final track on the album was one of the best, and one of the Beatles' favorites. It was revolutionary in its construction, and pointed the direction of some of their future endeavors. John originally wanted the background to consist of thousands of monks chanting, but that was a trifle impractical, so they used backward tapes, droning tambouras, lyrics taken from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and some unusual textures. Engineer Jeff Emmerich remembers the session.
Tomorrow Never Knows was the first track that was cut on Revolver. At that time, the multi-track machine was remote from the control room and the studio. It was in another room in the building. And I always remember the staff at Abbey Road sort of gathering, you know, outside the room, listening to all those backward loops and things which went on that track, you know, which, of course, no one had ever heard anything like that before.
It was skillfully put together by John, Paul, George, and George Martin.
And in Tomorrow Never Knows, John wanted a very spooky kind of track. He wanted a very ethereal kind of sound. The words are from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, as you know. And he told me he wanted his voice to sound like a Buddhist high priest singing from a mountaintop. Well, when we constructed the tape, the original version, what we started off with just a drum track from Ringo and a tambura drum. And then we laid down a voice, and to get the necessary effect on the voice, I put it through a Leslie speaker, which seemed to please him quite a bit.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. This is not dying. This is not dying.
They'd all got their own tape recorders. And I think it was Paul, I'm not sure, who found out that by removing the erase head on a recorder and putting a loop of tape on it, you could actually play a short phrase which saturated itself, but went round and round and overdubbed itself until the point of saturation and made a funny sound on that loop. And when you played it back, it was cute to listen to. And so they all vied with each other. They went home and all made these funny little loops, and they would bring various tape loops into me to listen to. And they recorded them at different speeds, you know, 1 7/8, 3 3/4, 7 1/2, 15. And with Tomorrow Never Knows, I would select, say, 8 of them and have them all, put them all on different machines. We had people all around the building, you know, connected up to our control panel with these silly loops held up with bits of pencil to keep the tension going eternally. And I then decided the best way to do it was to put it through on our mixer. And it was like an organ. By bringing up any one track, you could have any loop at any one time. But with that, we hadn't done it before in that way, and that it meant that on mixing was the actual performance. So that we had everybody on the mixer apart from the engineer. We had which was Jeff Emmerich. We had Paul on a couple of faders. We had John on another. I was on the pan pots. We were all make a concerted mix and just doing our own thing when we felt like the seagull noise should go across and so on. And we did many mixes and decided on which was the best one.
George Harrison thought the track was amazing, but was as unsure as the rest of them about its reception. He said, "I've been told that years ago when Ornette Coleman came along with his new sounds and jazz, everybody thought it was a bit weird. Perhaps we can do that as well, change the scene a bit, start new sounds, new directions." Well, they've begun to do just that. It would continue through all of their remaining albums. With these weighty matters to concern themselves with, the Beatles reluctantly face a 15-day tour of America. As they're getting ready to leave, reports are coming in about stations banning their music and ceremonial burnings of their records. The tour opened in Chicago on August 12th at the Chicago International Amphitheater. That afternoon, John held a press conference to try and patch things up.
I wasn't knocking it or putting it down. I was just saying it for the fact. And it sort of, it is true, especially more for England than here. No, but I'm not saying that we're better or greater or comparing us with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever it is. You know, I just said what I said and it was wrong or was taken wrong and now it's all this.
We accept his apology and in the manner in which it was offered. We think it's the least we can do. An offhand remark like this is not only dangerous, but it's... It can be very impressionable on the young folks, and we think that they have made a wise decision, and we accept their apology.
Some element of forgiveness must have been summoned up, as all of the tour dates were sold out, even in Memphis, near the heart of the original trouble. However, Ku Klux Klansmen picket the hall to protest John Lennon's religion remarks, and two firecrackers are thrown at them on stage. They also hold a news conference in Toronto.
John, may I ask you, what is it, in your estimation, that can and does really inspire young people today?
I don't know, honestly. You know, I just know that what we're doing inspires them to a degree, but not to inspire them to do anything else other than enjoy themselves.
Well, what you do excites them and makes them enjoy themselves.
Yeah,
what about inspiring them?
They get inspired by people who talk honestly to them, and not people who
talk in
take
riddles.
The long way around and talk in riddles. So they I think, you know, if they believe us on some things, it's because we can say it like they would think it, because, you know, we're exactly the same. And we don't pretend to be anything better than we are, you know.
Is there a possibility that the Beatles someday will break up?
Well, everything's possible, you know. But there's no answer to that. We're obviously not going to go around holding hands forever. We've got to split up or progress. I mean, we might, you know, it might happen, you know. It's quite possible.
With the Revolver album, are you trying to create trends?
No, I don't think we ever try to establish trends. You know, we try to keep moving forward and do something different. And if in the meantime it starts trends, you know, that's okay. But we never try consciously to start them. Thank you.
Another news conference in Seattle.
In regards to songwriting, have you ever attempted to, or would you attempt to write anything on your own without Paul or with another writer?
Well, I've written many things without Paul before, you know, for years. We've always written together and separately.
What about with, say, another writer?
Another writer I don't need, you know.
Good evening and everything. And we'd like to do a song now, which is off one of our LPs. And this is a song which is sung by...
And on August 29th, the Beatles perform what was to be their last live show as a group in San Francisco's Candlestick Park.
You tell!
Brian Epstein knew it was almost certainly the last performance. Feeling despondent, he said to his American public relations agent, Matt Weiss, "What will I do now? What will happen to my life? Should I go back to school and learn something else?" When they returned to London on August 31st, Paul says, "We had a good tour, but it was all very tiring."
I used to be frightened also in the Beatles. I remember many times just sitting outside concert halls being collected by the local police to be taken to them, just thinking, I really don't want to go through with this. You know, we've got enough money, let's take the money and run, and let's go down to Brighton.
George was a little more direct. He said categorically that he would never perform again on stage.
It was sort of a slow process. At first, you know, it was really nice to be booked on some place and know that the people were coming to because we'd had hit records and we started to make a bit of money and they came and we always had new songs to promote and stuff. But when we really got big, we got very bored with it because we had to do, really, you know, we had to do She Loves You and things. And it was not bad at first, but then we, you know, we just got tired of it and we were trapped ourselves because we couldn't really play anything else. We didn't have time to do anything else other than our own songs. And it got all very boring for us. And then the concerts got bigger and bigger.
John summed it up by saying, "We've had enough of performing forever. I can't imagine any reason which would make us do any sort of tour again. We're all really tired." It does nothing for us anymore, which is really unfair to the fans, we know, but we've got to think of ourselves. Ringo said, no one enjoyed touring. You can't really. Once you've got to manufacture it, it doesn't work.
It was the worst time and the best time in my life. I mean, the best time because we played a lot of good music and we had a lot of good times, and the worst time because it's not, touring is never a pleasure. Where it was like 24 hours a day with no break, press, and people fighting to get into your room, you know, climbing 25 stories of drain pipes, knocking on your window. I mean, it never stopped, and that was the, wasn't the good part of it. But the shows, I mean, no one ever complained about them. It was just that everything that went around us would have, if we'd have carried on, I personally would have gone insane.
On September 19th, John Lennon flies to Spain to play the part of the soldier Gripweed in How I Won the War, an anti-war film directed by Dick Lester. On September 20th, it's reported that George Harrison is in India studying sitar with Ravi Shankar and taking lessons in yoga. George first met Ravi Shankar in 1965 at a dinner in the home of the man who ran the Asian Music Center in London. He later went to George's house in Esher and gave him a quick sitar lesson and a private concert with the great tabla player Ala Rakar.
It was like remarkable the first time I listened to it, which was a Ravi Shankar album. You know, it is technically the most amazing music ever. But when I listened to the music, even though intellectually I didn't understand it, I felt within myself as though I knew it, and just knew it back to front.
On October 14th, it's reported that Paul McCartney is writing the musical score for a Hayley Mills film, Wedlocked, or All in Good Time. The title was later changed to The Family Way. On October 24th, Cardinal Cushing, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Boston, says he agrees. The Beatles are more popular than Jesus Christ. The fact is that the group is better known than Christianity throughout the world. On November 9th, John goes to an art exhibition at London's Indica Gallery and meets Yoko Ono for the first time.
Yoko was having an art exhibition at a gallery in London, and I used to go to the gallery occasionally to see what was happening, you know, and the other guy, and he said there was this artist going to have an event. I said, well, what's an event? He said, it's like a happening, only it's an event. I said, all right. And he said something about black bags. I said, very kinky. I was going to see, and he invited me there the night before it opened. Well, no, he said, it's black bags. Everybody's going to get in bags. I said, oh, I'm like, well, I don't want to get in the bag. I want to be the one that doesn't do it. And I spoils one watch. So we met there, you know, and there was just a few people in the gallery, and I was wandering around trying to not look like John Lennon. And, you know,
he so didn't look like,
well, she
you
didn't know,
well, I didn't know,
Adam,
you
anyway.
Know.
And then we met, she had a painting which is a ladder, and there's a painting on the ceiling with a spyglass hanging on a chain from it, and you climb up the ladder and lift the spyglass and read a little word, and it says yes.
On November 24th, the Beatles start recording. It's their first work together since the U.S. tour ended. The sessions are for Sgt. Pepper. On December 10th, 1966, Parlophone releases another album. It's called A Collection of Beatles Oldies. It's Christmas time again, and since there's no new product from the Fab Four, a predictable collection of oldies was hastily assembled, and it was all crammed into an inferior Carnaby Street-style cover. The only all-new track on the LP was Larry Williams' Bad Boy, which had been released in America in 1965.
Behave yourself. Buy every rock and roll book on a magazine stand. Every dime that he gets is off to the jukebox man. Well, he worries and teases until at night she's ready to poop. From rocking and a rolling, spinning and a hoo. Junior, behave yourself.
On December 16, 1966, the Beatles fan club releases a special Christmas record. Their fourth message is a recorded pantomime called Everywhere It's Christmas.
Everywhere it's Christmas, everywhere it's home. London,
Paris,
and New York,
Tokyo, Hong Kong. Oh, everywhere it's Christmas,
and I'm off to join the charm.
Christmas.
At the end of every year.
Oh, everywhere is Christmas. At the end of every year.
I said that.
Everywhere is Christmas. At the end of every year.
One more time.
Our story opens in Corsica. On the veranda is a bearded man in glasses conducting a small choir.
Meanwhile, high in the Swiss Alps, two elderly Scotchmen munch on a rare cheese.
Wonderful stuff, this, Agnes.
Aye, it's wonderful stuff.
Tadalee! Tadalee!
standing in the entrance to the main tent. Immediately behind me, the festivities have already begun.
Tell me, are you enjoying the wine?
I am indeed, Your Highness.
Hey,
that's well with me.
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Very good. Very good. Well,
the king seems to be enjoying himself tonight.
You know, don't feed him on that good food since the October Festival.
At the same time as this, in the captain's mess on board HMS Tremendous, a toast is being proposed.
To Her Majesty!
To Her Majesty!
Podgy the Bear and Jasper were huddled around the unlit fire in the center of the room.
There are no more matches left, Podgy,
said Jasper.
Then buy some, Jasper, old friend,
said Podgy.
Make a list, and afterwards we'll go to the shop and buy matches and candles and buns.
There's no more paper to write on, Podgy.
No need to worry, Jasper. You keep saying to yourself matches, and I'll keep saying candles until we reach the shop. Then we won't need to write it down. We'll remember.
We'll remember the buns, Podgy.
We both will, Jasper. Matches.
Candles.
Matches.
Candles.
Matches.
Candles.
Matches.
Candles.
In the long dark corridors of Felpin Mansions, a door slams. And the shadowy figure of Count Balder appears. The Count is the eccentric son of Baron Landsberg, the inventor of the rack. He speaks.
Guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren. Welcome to Felpin Mansions. Butler will show you to your rooms. Butler!
Yes, sir?
Tell the ladies and gentlemen to their rooms.
Yes, sir. Come this way, please.
Come in.
May I come in?
Come in, Count.
May I?
Oh, yes, come in.
Ah, thank you. I'm wondering if you knew any of the songs from the good old days.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, don't you worry on that score. I hear the Baron likes, I hear the Baron likes the good old tune.
Yes, I do.
How do I, Count? How do I? Well, they're all melody, aren't they? No, don't you worry, I'll play him this one. He liked this one. Is it? Listen to this one. Please don't bring your banjo back. I know where it's been. I wasn't hardly gone a day when it became a thing. Banjos, banjos, all the time. I can't forget that tune. And if I ever see another banjo, I'm going out to buy a big balloon.
And if I ever see another banjo, I'm going out to buy a big balloon. And if I ever see another banjo, I'm going out to buy a big balloon.
Yes, everywhere it's Christmas.
Everywhere it's Christmas. Everywhere it's the sun. London,
Paris, oh, and New York,
Tokyo, Hong Kong.
Oh, everywhere it's Christmas.
And I'm off to join the charm.
Everywhere it's Christmas.
At the end.